Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Leibniz, a German philosopher, a very, I suppose, prolific, a key philosopher, where he stands as sort of as a giant of a mind, but standing in between the ancients, Descartes, linking on to Kant, but he's basically a Christian Catholic philosopher, and he's dealing with some basic questions just before we have, just at the time of Newton, and he's a parallel competitor with Newton, and he's more extreme than Newton in terms of you start off with the idea that God exists and goes forward. I'll give you a bit more of background into that. Firstly off about podcasts, you'll notice that in this podcast, if you go to the blog or either podcast, hopefully you'll be able to click on a link to the app. So the app orders the podcasts by subject in sequence and will eventually go. So at the moment you just click on the MP4, but I'll have it such that you can click. There'll be other buttons on there for MP3 and quiz, all the basic stuff, and I'll just wind things back. Now why I have to go up to podcasts, this is a side thing, is that the Feedburner is protesting at the rate of which I'm producing podcasts. It's just saying that there's too many megabytes of podcasts out there. And each podcast is very small, there's not a lot to it, it's just reference, but nonetheless, occasionally I put a photograph or a picture in to explain what I'm talking about, so it builds up and expands, and at the end of the day, the idea of producing such a high quantity for podcasts for use at school, I should be able to get on the app, press on your class, an area, number, or subject, and be able to go through it. So it's, at the moment, people tend to get podcasts in the general area and start to go through and listen to them. And this is more of actually putting it directly into a library, which is rather interesting because Leibniz, getting back to Leibniz, he is a librarian. And you can sort of see that in he's almost got a Dewey Decimal System of thought in the way that he goes here. And he doesn't have a central work like Newton or Descartes or something like that, but he's more of producing a library. That's, I think that's the insight to get across. There's a library of different books, and people, I think, even today have only got halfway through. And obviously his interest in him is academic. I think time has overtaken him. He's asking fundamental questions which albeit have been answered. He's taken a philosophical position against atoms, and the answer is there is atoms. He's taken a philosophical position against the tenets of quantum mechanics, and the answer is there is quantum mechanics. So the basic nature of the world. But he's actually, just going back to it, there's section one of this Stanford thing is on a general introduction of how important he is in the introduction. Section two is about his life and what he did and how he's treated. So eventually he worked in the library as of these various people of the Hanoverian court, and Hanover took over the UK. So the UK began to be ruled by these George the First. Pretty interesting story. And so that gave him his history, and it's interesting that his antagonism to Newton meant that the English excluded him. It's pretty astonishing type of thing to go. And it's also interesting to look at the way that the Germans were all working, what was going on in Germany. It's also interesting in the idea of continue a little bit longer. Section three is about his various principles, and there's six principles, and they are just mind-bendingly sort of like proto-philosophical, proto-logical proto, I'm just trying to think of the word. It's before philosophy. You know, it's just really, really struck me. There's formal logic, you know, Boolean logic, that people who wrote it down. It's computer science logic. You know, Booleans, this is not a member of that class. And there's sort of the tilts towards set theory. Right? So a lot of things he says in a long argument, you can say, oh, well, that's a reference to that set theory, or there would be a thing he'll say about separability of objects or substances that's still towards it. That gets on to, that's the third part, the principles, and those three principles run amok in terms of substance. And you say, well, what substance? Well, he's doing the fundamental things that philosophers do. He asks, what is, you know, what is something in front of him? And he comes up with some ideas which, when you say, when it's stated, you nowadays, if you ask the physicist, you say, well, that's, it's impossible. A small object can't contain all the information of the universe before and after, in terms of information theory. But when I sort of really think about it, he's really talking about there's a number of problems with what he says in terms of physics, or I can see a number of problems with physics. However, what I think he is talking about is the truth of how we conceive an object. The it's more comprehensibility, how it is comprehended. So I see an object, I can, an electron by itself is, it's got a limited amount of information, but I'm allowed to think as much as I like about it. And the fact that what he states isn't true is just one way of thinking about the complexity and chaos of that ilk of things. So that being said, so let's summarise what I've said before. I've given you general introduction to Leibniz. He's a philosopher who's really brought forward ancient philosophy, the most ancient philosophy of them all. That's the really first thing that Pythagoras did, is he drew a circle in the sand. I'm going to put this in a picture. He drew a circle in the sand and put a dot in the centre of it and said, We're going to contemplate the smallest reducible thing, a monad. And Leibniz, all these centuries later, is a monadist. He's looking at that center of point. Now, this is interesting, that the Pythagorean reduction to worship of mathematics means that it actually comes out of Leibniz's work. The maths come through. And so you've got all that thing across. Then you've got the Aristotelian views of matter and form and substance and existence. And here, of course, if you have the answer must be God, you get a whole series of circular arguments, or basically circular arguments, that everything has a soul, that nothing exists. He sort of bounces off, sort of recoils off Descartes' views. And in a sense, he's a very important. There's a big chopper coming over the top at the moment. Sorry if there's a big noise here. I'm going to say it's a flying pigs, but it's a police chopper going over the top. So, and it's travelling in such a way. When it's interesting that you can see when they're searching for things, they know how choppers, when they're going from point A to point B, they go when they're actually looking at it's got its landing lights on, so there's something going on here. Getting back to it. So this is Leibniz, and he's just been thrown into by picking up Pythagoras, which is mathematically, he's sort of, that mathematical spin is actually pushing him towards the maths. And of course, Leibniz, in the worship of numbers, have come up with the binary system. So he's really important to our modern day world. He is the father of the digital age, in terms of that he says one is God and not God is zero. And you should be able to construct a number system out of ones and noughts. It's pretty amazing when it comes across. It hasn't come up so far in this, but you can see him just getting very close to quantum mechanics, but not close enough there. So as you can just probably see, I'm a fairly gentle person. There you go. I'm a gentle person and I don't dislike anyone in particular. I don't think anyone's particularly stupid or right or wrong. I don't hate anyone or anything like that. So I'm prepared to look at Leibniz and say, look, there's a lot of potential in here. I can sort of see how he links at the time. And I think very much people really are who they are for the time that they're in. So I'm very much, perhaps I'm ahead of my time. I don't know why, but Leibniz is ahead of his time, but he is ultimately still in his own time, and it's a very honest. You can see this person to work so hard is very honest. Honest here, whereas you come across a lot of political people who are not of their own time. They're thinking of the future or trying to deceive you. You don't get this at all. Reading Leibniz, you see him as a fairly honest, straightforward, untricky person. Whereas Newton's a bit of a slippery character when you really get to know him. Let's go forward to, we're at the end of four. So four is where he's actually putting all the principles of three, so, which is put in three. He's trying to ask, what is substance? And he's come up with these ideas that substance is, saying atoms are not true, so he's got this indivisible problem, and he's saying the only substances have soul, and so if that rock doesn't have a soul, and the rock's moved, it's got all this Platonic view of, Aristotelian view that things move because of a cause, and he's got a view that the mind is separate from the body, completely separate from the body, except you've got this ancient belief that the mind is connected to the body by the pineal gland. Where do they come up with that one? This is the pine's cone at the bottom there, but this parallel pendulum, they actually, the mind operates separate from the body, which is a very ancient philosophy, which I really can't think of, which has gone into another school of German thought. So you can see these ancient thoughts, I don't know what it really means, but another ancient group where the Germans began to see cells, and when they saw cells, they saw individual atoms moving about of their own accord, a sort of social knowledge of how everything has to move. We'll get back now. We're on to 4.5. Oh dear. Efficient and final causes and the kingdom of nature and grace. So efficient and final cause are straight off. Aristotle, I haven't read through. Let's see, he's got his efficient cause would be cause number three, and the final cause would be cause number four. And I don't know, you can, various times I try to understand Aristotle, and ultimately it's a very complex circular argument. Plato is a bit more interesting, I think, in terms of the idea of the idea of forms, that we are still in, we're still objects in a mind of God, and I don't really, I just pick that Platonic view in Kant. Here is a lot, Leibniz actually doesn't quite do that, and so he's actually more contemporary of Newton. So Kant was worried that both Leibniz and Newton were explaining things, and if you could explain things, you know, what is there a role for God? But here we go. Leibniz accounts of the pre-established harmony of the mind and body is part of a more general position in his metaphysics, the existence of parallel modes of explanation, which is either his parallel pendulum that the body is moving and the mind is moving, and they communicate somehow, but they're on separate courses. As we saw above, Leibniz believes that the mind will act according to the laws, and the body will act according to its laws, and the two will be in harmony. The mind and the body are separate. Pretty amazing things, like pendulum. However, isn't it amazing, the pendulum problem is the basics of quantum mechanics. But Leibniz also believes the mind, our soul, operates for particular ends, and therefore the actions are explicable in terms of final causes, whereas the action of the body, purely instances of matter in motion according to the claims of mechanical philosophy, are to be explained in terms of efficient causes. Oh, God. As he puts it in Monadology, volumes 79 and 81, can I actually say monad? You'd have to really understand. It would, if you hadn't read enough philosophy, monadology would just make absolutely no sense to you. So hopefully I can help with it. A monad is a circle with a dot in it, drawn by Plato, and has launched many ideas and has crept back into our schools in the form of the Bohr atom. Souls act according to the laws of final causes, though appetition ends in through appetitions, appetites, ends and means. Bodies act according to the laws of efficient causes of motion. And these two kingdoms, that the efficient cause, the final causes, are in harmony with each other. So he's, I think this is actually quite a sensible thing. He's looked at Aristotle's four causes and said, look, mechanics is really centered on the third cause, and emotion and thought is, and our social conceptual construct is by the fourth cause. So Aristotle has four causes. According to this system, I should say that I was taught about, my father was Australia's first computer programmer and first computer scientist, and he was also a theologian, so he taught me about the causes of Aristotle. So I know that very small, from a small kid. According to the systems, bodies exist if there were no souls, as if, though this is impossible, and souls act as if there's no body, and both act as if the, acts as if the influenced by the other. In the realm of natural philosophy, Leibniz will say clearly, all corporeal phenomena can be derived from efficient and mechanical causes, though there are final causes or higher reasons that underlie them. But Leibniz pushes the parallelism further. So this is very, very different, and when you really come to think of it, Newton has absolute space and point bodies. Descartes has extensions, and this sort of cuts through both of it. This is quoting Leibniz. In general, we must hold that everything in the world can be explained in two ways: through the kingdom of power, that is through efficient cause, and through the kingdom of wisdom, that is final cause. Okay, through God governing bodies for His glory, like an architect governing them as machines that follow the law of size, or mathematics governing them indeed, for the use of souls, and through God governing His glory and souls capable of wisdom, governing them for His fellow citizens, members with Him of a certain society, governing them like a prince indeed, like a father, through the laws of goodness and moral laws. That's interesting. It's also interesting that maths is used again and again by the philosophers. So you've got, I'll have to go back and reread Richard de Cusa, but he uses a whole lot of maths and infinities and that type of stuff to explain things. And this is to say, I don't know, this is like guns and war, you know, the bullet flies out of the gun, but you've actually pointed the gun to do certain things. I don't know. Though Leibniz speaks here of the kingdoms of power and wisdom, the two-tiered explanatory approach, the phenomena of the natural world explained through efficient cause and the actions of the mind explained through final cause, leads to a distinction between what he more commonly calls the kingdom of nature and the kingdom of grace. See Monadology, volume 87. This uses Leibniz's views. We can understand the world as if designed by God, the perfect engineer architect. And we can also understand the world as if ordered by, guided by God, a supreme monarch who concerns solely with the happiness of his subjects. There's obvious problems in this, but what I really do think of that, this is also you know, how the mind constructs things. I think the mind does construct things for a reason, you know, and that's essentially, you know, essentially, I think what's really interesting is, what is the logic of possessing anything that astounds me? What is the logic of someone? There is an object that's got all these properties, and I can introduce a completely new property which cannot be measured. It's a complete social construct that someone owns it. That's just stunning. The amount of philosophy, whatever it is, to say that rock over there is my rock and not yours. So you have to ask me to do it. So it's this thing that a rock is a rock, and you can measure it, you can hit it with the laser beams, you can do it or something. But the idea of someone owning that rock is a pretty amazing thing, and the moral philosophy which goes with it. And so all of this is, I suppose, bunkum. It's actually hardwired into our society through things like money and ownership. You know, like, it's a great thing. Money is a great thing. I can earn it, store it in my, I can do work at one place, store it up, and actually, with that work, buy it later on. So this philosophy, even though it's bunk, is highly, highly valuable. Okay, now we're into metaphysics. Leibnizian idealism. 5.1, monads and the world of phenomena. Again, a monad. Physically, it's great. This is a philosophy. What's a monad? Well, you can look the word monad up in Wikipedia and on the net, and it's a circle with a dot. What I love about it is the monad is a symbol that we have used to erroneously describe an atom. Yet this person, by using monads, does not believe in atoms. There's a sort of an irony in it, which is rather far-reaching. Thus far, this is quoting the story here, thus far, this, if you can call it a story, thus far we have seen that Leibniz rejected the Cartesian account of matter, which is matter is an extension of things, according to which, according to which the essence of which is extension could be considered a substance. Leibniz held instead that only beings endowed with true unity are capable of action that count as substances. This is madness. The ultimate expression of Leibniz's view comes from his celebrated theory of monads, in which the only beings that will count as genuine substances and hence be considered real are the mind-like simple substances endowed with perception and appetite. What this is I think appetite you can describe in modern computer science as BID, belief. Belief, desire, intention. Okay. Which is really funny, artificial intelligence. Well, what was said above concerning the unity and activity of simple substances should suffice to explain Leibniz's reason for holding such a position. Now, a fuller version of Leibniz's idealism must be represented. Wow. Okay, according to Leibniz, if only genuine real beings are mind-like simple substances, i.e., yeah, a guinea pig is a real thing because it senses and it's got something, but the bed its guinea pig is sleeping in is not a real substance. There we go. Then bodies, motion, and everything else must result from being derivative from those simple substances and their perceptual states. A simple statement of his idealism, Leibniz says, quote, I don't really eliminate the body, but reduce, revoco it to what it is, for I show that corporal mass, massa, which is thought to have something over and above the simple substances, is not a substance, but a phenomenon resulting from simple substances, which alone have unity and absolute reality. It's interesting, and I think the discovery of mass, and this is mass before his corporal massa, is the is an ancient theory, but it's not a modern theory of mass. Newton came up against it, and it was Giles of Rome who began to actually get into it. And Newton got a bit close to mass, and Giles of Rome was the first person which ticked over what mass is when he was trying to explain transubstantiation. So, it's really interesting to read this. Yet this position, denying the reality of bodies and asserting that monads are the grounds of all corporal phenomena, as well as the metaphysical corollaries, has shocked many. That's the person I was trying to remember. He's Bertrand Russell. That's the one with the formal logic, for example, famously remarked in a preface to his book on Leibniz. Oh, well, that would be a book to read. On Leibniz, that he felt that the monadology was a kind of fantastic fairy tale, coherent perhaps, but wholly arbitrary. I couldn't agree with him more. However, it's a very important fairy tale. That's what that's my opinion of it as well. It's a fairy tale. It's wholly arbitrary. It is coherent, but it is that necessary thing to spur to move between Newton, Descartes, and Kant. And in perhaps the wittiest and most biting rhetorical question asked of Leibniz, Voltaire jibes. Can you really believe that a drop of urine is an infinity of monads, and each of these has ideas, however obscure, of the universe as a whole? Well, if you're Leibniz, you can, but how so? Well, I don't think... Well, my interpretation is urine's not on the table, so to speak. 5.2. Wait for this word, and you can use it at a dinner table anywhere. It'll get you into clubs anywhere. So the word is 5.2. Pan-organicism and idealism. Well, that's a word, and it's not in use today, but Leibniz needed it. When Leibniz argues that bodies are the results of monads and that matter itself is a phenomenon, he has something very specific in mind. First, Leibniz's system, there is a special kind of order in the natural world corresponding to the hierarchy of monads. Consider the first well-known comment that Leibniz makes to De Volta, introducing a fivefold ontological scheme. So this is a system of knowledge. I distinguish one, primitive entrelechy or soul. I don't know what that means. Two, the matter, namely the primary matter or primitive passive power. Three, the monad made up of these two things. Four, the massa, or secondary matter, or organic machine in which innumerable subordinate monads come together. And five, the animal, that is, the corporal substance, which the dominating monads makes into one machine. Wow. So there's mass and monads in there, and it's really interesting, this interesting story. So Leibniz is someone who's really dealt with mass, but what does it mean? What does it mean? So it isn't, that's a big interest to me, because I was looking at, Newton specifically doesn't really deal with mass. He sort of says something about density, and if something's very dense, a small volume of it will then have a greater mass. He uses density as a way to get to mass. He doesn't really, and then I don't know what it is. Look for Giles of Rome. This is St. Giles of Rome, but he just referenced that. And Newton does actually refer to a lot of things. When you read it here, you say, come on, say something. And it's really, he says, these three laws of motion, they're already well known. What? And then it's all his three laws of motion are not, as we say it, that's what English people have taught, these laws of motion. His laws of motion are really, deal with momentum if you read the Latin of it. Okay. So he's got an animal has got the five level things from soul mixed back into matter, back into the soul, into the objects. One of the points We're back again after a break. I had to break off and buy football tickets on the internet for my family who are going to see the Hawthorn versus Sydney match. We're just going through here, and just to summarise, he's had basic building blocks, then he's built what's a substance and what's not, and now he's actually going into the kill and looking at substances one, section four. Section four is what is a substance, and now section five here is what is a person, what is a thing going through. It's quite interesting. He's got this ancient belief of monads, and he's going through and whether monads make a machine. One of the points Leibniz is making here is an animal. In an animal, there is a dominant monad that bears a special relation to all monads subordinate to it to make an organic machine of that animal. But ultimately, the picture is even more complex than this, for each of those subordinate monads can be considered as having an organic machine attached to it, and this relation continues infinitely small. Thus, for example, Leibniz writes in Monadology, quote, thus we can see each living body has a dominant entelechy, which I suppose is soul, so it's entelechy, which in the animal is the soul, but the limbs and the living body are full of other living beings, plants, animals, such of which are also has an entelechy or a dominant soul, which is also like almost like cells, I suppose. Similarly, in a letter to, which is also very interesting because, in your head you can have, well, multiple subconscious going on and stuff like that. Similarly, in a letter to Berling, he writes, quote, any mass contains innumerable monads, for although any one organic body in nature has a corresponding dominant monad, it nevertheless contains in its parts other monads endowed in the same way, with organic bodies subservient to the primary one. And the whole of nature is nothing else, for it is necessary that every aggregate result from simple substances, as if it's from the elements. A bit hard to conceive this, but obviously, as the people going down the track say, I'm just looking at the top here, Voltaire, remind you, said, can you really believe a drop of urine has an infinity of monads, and each of these has ideas, however obscure, of the universe as a whole. That's amazing. I think he's really burnt himself out here. In other words, each monad will have an organic body, which in turn is composed of it. Monads each likewise will have an organic body. Similarly, any seemingly inanimate chunks of matter, stone, yes, a drop of urine, will result an infinity of monads in their organic bodies, which are nothing more than more monads and their organic bodies. In this view, is associated with a pan-organicist strand of Leibniz thought. And it is for this reason that Leibniz will claim that all of nature is full of life, principle of nature and grace, and that there are infinite degrees of life in monads. Wow. Which is, I think you've got to really interpret this as a construction of reality in your head. Second, there is what can best be described as a genuinely idealist strand of Leibniz thought. That is, if idealism is the thesis that the only things that truly exist are the minds and their ideas, then Leibniz clearly espouses this doctrine. This is what basically I think he's gone to. I would have said here the operative idea is that bodies, and in particular the bodies associated with particular minds, are intentional objects, they result from or are grounded in monads. This is what Leibniz is getting at in the following passage from another letter to Dvorka. Quote, consider the matter carefully. You must say that there is nothing in things but simple substances, and in them perception and appetition, appetites. Moreover, matter and motion are not substances or things as such as they are phenomena for the perceivers, the reality of which is situated in the harmony of the perceivers within themselves at different times and with other perceivers. Wow, this is again the ancient Greek view that, you know, light comes from the inside of your eyes. Thus, only real things are simple substances. The bodies that we perceive in the motion around us are phenomena, and not themselves substances, although they are grounded ultimately in simple substances of monads, mind, twister. Moreover, the bodies of natural world ought to be considered intentional objects in that they are objects about which we have certain beliefs. This is what Leibniz means in saying that they have really a reality insofar as there is harmony between perceivers or between the same perceiver's beliefs or perceptions at different times. In other words, one's body or even a stone is real because it's an object or perception that fits into our account of the world, and both coherent from the point of view of a single perceiver and harmony with the perception of the mind. This is basically a brain in a bottle trying to work out things. Perspective and divine emanation. My Godfather. 5.3. Still, Leibniz's version of idealism tends to produce confusion precisely because there are two strands. The commitment to embodiment of nomads along with the rejection of reality of bodies. There you go. I was a bit confused there. The view that monads are not spatial but have a point of view. Leibniz's point, however, is that while monads are not extended, they do have a situation so far they bear an ordered relation to bodies throughout the body in which they are present or through the body of which they represent themselves as being attached. Okay, so monads are getting very close to being atoms, I think. In other words, the Leibnizian monadology is simply substances are mind-like entities that do not, strictly speaking, exist in space, but represent the universe from a unique perspective, which is also true. I think it's interesting that people who are against this often muck up what band gap diagrams. They can't comprehend. You can have a math picture of mathematics. Here we go. Leibniz's conception of such perceptible universe has, however, distinctly Platonist origin. There you go. Again, this is it's a Neoplatonist. Again, each mind-like simple substance represents itself as having a body and a position relative to other bodies, but in doing so, each simple substance offers a perspective on the world for the divine mind. This idea comes out very clearly on the Discourse of Metaphysics, where Leibniz writes the following. Now, first of all, it's very evident that created substances depend on God, who perceives them and who even produces them continually by a kind of emanation. God. God directly. Just as we produce our thoughts. Okay. Which is really inside the, you know, we're inside God's mind. For God, so to speak, it turns on all sides and all ways the general system of phenomena which he finds it good to produce in order to manifest his glory, and has views all faces of the world in all ways possible, since there is no relation that escapes his omniscience. The result is that each view of the universe is seen from a particular position, is a substance which expresses the universe in conformity with this view. Should God sit feet fit to render his thought actual and to produce his substance. The important thing is that this is put out in full cold facts, the actual thinking of Newton. One of the things is Newton, he's just a stream of consciousness running principally. Then I went to the lab, then I put this in a box, and I spun that, and then I think that it's close to a lab book. But Newton, at the end of the day, believed that God was pushing everything. So they're pretty much the same thing. So it's interesting to see that it's got to go from Newton to Leibniz to Kant and via Descartes before we finally get away from God doing everything. This is a striking passage. It's incomprehensible to me, mate. Leibniz is telling us that each finite substance is a result of a different perspective of God, which can take can take of the universe, and each created substance is an emanation of God. The argument here can be expressed in several different ways. First, since God could occupy any and all points of view in the universe, there must be a simple substance to represent the world from that perspective. And since the simple substance must have representations of unique perspective, it must be a mind-like substance, a monad, capable of having perceptions. Second, the stronger God omniscience entails knowledge of the world from every perspective simultaneously. The infinite perspective of the world originating from God's nature simply are monads. So he's really gotten the first idea, the very first idea of philosophy, and taking it fully across. So the first idea of philosophy, Pythagoras drew a circle in the sand, put a dot, and that was the monads. It's really, really interesting. Oh my God. Monadic hierarchy. You couldn't read this unless you'd understood some Pythagoras. If only things that are truly exist are mind-like entities, monads, then the difference between them must be explicable in terms of mental features. Now, it is stated above that the central feature of Leibniz's account of substances was his claim that substances are endowed with active and passive forces. In his Mature Metaphysics, Leibniz expressed this view somewhat differently by saying that substance is active insofar it has distinct perceptions and passive insofar it has confused perceptions. Oh my Godfather, this is so dumb, I can't believe it. Thus, for example, I think it must be in chapter 49 of Mundology, Leibniz writes that, quote, we attribute action, this is the idea of action, to a monad insofar it has distinct perceptions, and passion insofar it has confused passions. God, that is so confused. But, as we learn later in the same work, monads are all go confusedly to infinity, to the whole, but they are limited and differentiated by degrees of distinct perceptions. My God, he's wacko. The fundamental ideas here are twofold. First, activity and passivity are features of relative clarity and distinctness of representation of monad, and second, insofar as organic bodies of particular monad are themselves constituted by monads, they are monads of organic bodies, will have confused perceptions. This change goes down to the infinitely small, with monads having only very confused and inexact perceptions of the world. Is that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle? I really don't know. Oh, God. Since there is hierarchy among monads within any animal, from the soul of a person down to the infinitely small monad, the relationship of domination and subordination among monads is a crucial feature of both Leibniz's idealism and his pan-organicism. But the hierarchy of substances is not simply one of containment, in which one monad in an organic body is the result of other monads, each of which has an organic body, and so on. In the case of animals, brutes, and human beings, the hierarchy of monads is related to the control of the machine of nature, as Leibniz had put it in a letter to Volta considered above. What is then that he explains the relation of domination and subordinate monads? As Leibniz tells, the bosses, domination and subordination consists of degrees of perfection. Since monads are to be differentiated in terms of their perceptions, one natural reading would be simply be suggested that in a paragraph above, monad X is dominant over monad Y, then X has a clearer perceptions than Y. Oh God, he's insane. But if we follow the description of appearance of causal interaction, we find that in Monadology, chapters 49 to 51, we can get a slightly more sophisticated picture. Monad X is dominant over monad Y when X contains within it the reasons for actions of monad Y. This is why in the mind of an animal can be said to be direct action of its body, and why, for example, there will be a hierarchy of functionality within one animal. Thus, one mind has clearer perceptions of those contained in the monads of organic body, but it contains reasons for everything that happens in one of the bodies. One liver contains the reason for what happens in the cells. The cells contain reasons for what happens in the mitochondria. And according to Leibniz, this relation continues infinitely down, so on. Well, that's, we've got chapter 6, epistemology, to go through. So what was that? We did 3 was the principles. 4 was substances. 5, I really can't... Oh, yeah, 5 is what we're doing, is animals and beings, and that those substances put into it. And this monadism, which is this ancient idea, has now got completely out of control, as far as I can see. Thanks for listening, and we'll see how much more we've got to go. We've got chapter 6. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.